Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for June 6, 2021. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and here, as I am every Sunday, discussing the big events in pro wrestling with you. That's every Sunday with a caveat, because next Sunday is the NXT In Your House Takeover, which we'll be previewing right here on this show tonight. And after NXT Takeover In Your House goes off the air, the gentleman from NXT, PWT Talks NXT, including Tom Staupe, Nate Lindberg, and Kelly Wells, will be guiding you through the results of that show. So they will be here, as they tend to be, on Wrestling Night in America post-NXT takeovers, now that takeovers have moved to Sunday night. I often ask them to kind of take over, if you will, Wrestling Night in America. So they'll be here with you after takeover next week. So make sure to call in, send them emails, and listen to the show. They'd love to have you. Tonight, as I said, we'll preview that edition of TakeOver. And to start, though, I want to talk about the NWA When Our Shadows Fall pay-per-view that actually occurred earlier today at 4 p.m. Eastern on Fight TV. It lasted about 2 hours, a little under 2 hours, actually. An hour and 58 minutes I had it timed at. So this was, you know, if you're not familiar, the NWA is back. It's not on YouTube where it once was. It's on Fight TV, and you have to pay for the weekly show every Tuesday there. So Joe Galli, Tim Storm, and Velvet Sky were your announcers for this show. It began with a four-team match. It was Marche Rocket and Slice Boogie versus Perro and Odinson, known as The End, versus Sal Renaro and Rudo, with Danny Deals as their manager, versus Mecha Wolf and Bestia 666, also known as The Rebellion. Now, the last team there is from AAA, so we're seeing AAA involved in exchanging talent with the NWA. It's a lot to keep track of these days with so many promotions working together. Definitely a good thing, but hard to keep track of sometimes. This was NWA Lucha Libre rules, where no tags were needed. As soon as a team member, a legal team member, hit the floor, their feet hit the floor, the other team member could join the match legally. The announcers went to great pains to explain those rules. However, it was not exactly followed by the wrestlers involved. This was Rudo's NWA debut, and he got the spotlight here at various times. However, the team from AAA got the victory. It was Mecha Wolf and Bestia 666 with the victory. So we'll see how long they are in NWA and see if they can make a tag title shot out of this. I tweeted during the show, and you can follow me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks, where I try to tweet live as much as possible in terms of wrestling shows and pay-per-views. I mentioned there that the NWA, from what I've seen, and I don't keep up with their weekly shows, but from what I've seen of their weekly shows in the past, what I've seen of their pay-per-views, it is a company that does not exactly have a ton of athletic performers, a lot of old school performers. Athleticism, I wouldn't say, is high on their list. So this was a match that did bring the athleticism. So that was nice to see them lead off the show with some more athleticism than we're used to seeing on these shows. Post-match, there's a stare down between the team of Perro and Odinson and the Rebellion. So that could be something. If the Rebellion doesn't get a tag title shot soon, then that could be something that they're building toward sooner rather than later. The Pope versus Tyrus was match number two. Tyrus was managed by Austin Idol. This is a non-title match, as the Pope is the TV champion in the NWA. Tyrus won with a heart punch and a foreign object handed to him by Austin Idol. I kind of joked on Twitter that Idol should be the one wrestling and Tyrus is the manager. It's boggles the mind, first of all, that Tyrus is wrestling. He's just so... it's a struggle for him out there, let me just say that. And then to see him go over and to see him wrestle in such a long match, you know, it's pretty clear that whatever complaints that were done about Tyrus the last pay-per-view that were put out there into the social media stratosphere, NWA didn't take much heed of, because not only did Tyrus go over, but it was a long match, and he was on offense for most of it, which is probably better than Tyrus selling for most of the match, admittedly. But there's just, he's very limited. He's very limited in the ring at this point. But he gets the victory over to Pope. Match number three was a women's tag match featuring Melina and Thunder Rosa against Taryn Terrell and Kylie Rae. This was a win for Taryn Terrell and Kylie Rae. Kylie Rae making her NWA debut. It was posted by PW Insider earlier today that Kylie Rae is now under contract to NWA. She was able to get out of her Impact contract and has signed with the NWA, so she'll be NWA going forward. Thunder Rosa grabbed Taryn and ran to the back with her, and Kylie ended up pinning Melina using the tights. Now, if you're thinking Smiley Kylie using the tights for a victory, she did seem to regret that after the match, so I'm not sure where they're going with that exactly. But it's hard to see her as anything other than a babyface at this point. Mostly Kylie Rae and Thunder Rosa in there. It's hard to get a read on Taryn Terrell. You know, she had come a long way from her WWE days in terms of her in-ring work when she was in TNA and working there, and had shown a lot of obvious improvement with Gail Kim. But she just didn't see enough of her, I don't think, in this to really make an opinion. Match number four was Fred Rosser versus JTG, arguably the match of the night. I really enjoyed this match. This was the NWA debut of JTG as well. He ended up getting the victory over Rosser with the inside cradle. Rosser had been working for New Japan Wrestling, their American affiliation out there in California, and his improvement has shown the former Darren Young in WWE. And the one thing I'll say about both of these guys, they were in tremendous physical shape, both cardio-wise as well as aesthetically. They were in great shape, so that was really cool to see. We'll see where JTG goes from here. A couple NWA debuts in this show. NWA tag titles were on the line in match number five, Crimson and Jack Stain, the War Kings, against Tom Latimer and Chris Adonis, and also Aaron Stevens and J.R. Kratos, who were the champions. So it was a triple threat NWA tag title match. This was won by Stevens and Kratos. Kratos sold the knee for much of the early part of the match, and this was a storyline where the champions could not get along. However, they ended up getting the victory. This was a lot of guys who are kind of the same wrestler in this match, it felt like, and there was really no one to carry the body of the match, and it struggled to keep my interest in this one. Match number six was Camille versus Serena Deeb for the NWA Women's Championship. Title changes hands here. Camille is your new NWA champion, women's champion. She wins with the spear. Really good match. It's so cool to see Serena. You know, she's done great work on when she's been on AEW, whether Dynamite or on the pre-show of the last pay-per-view. And the one thing that you see from her is not only do you see something new in every match from her, but she's so good at adapting her style to the style of her opponent. And she did it again here. Camille not maybe as seasoned as some of the other wrestlers she's fought, although she's wrestled some pretty young stars in AEW as well. But, you know, this was a really good match. Camille gets the victory. It'll be interesting to see if AEW uses her the same way they used Thunder Rosa when she was NWA champion, the same way they used Serena when she was NWA champion. I think this would be the best for Camille to be able to work in that environment in AEW with some of the talented women they have on that roster. I would be interested in seeing that. And then finally, the main event, Nick Aldis defending the NWA Heavyweight Championship against Trevor Murdoch. Aldis retaining the title, winning by disqualification. So Aldis hit the ref from behind with a chair, so the ref didn't see who hit him, and then he used the chair on Murdoch. Murdoch got the chair away from him and used it on Aldis, at which point the referee had woken up, saw Murdoch using the chair, awarded the match via disqualification to Aldis. After the match, Trevor Murdoch cut a promo, very distraught, not sure where he goes from here, gave it his all, so it'll be interesting to see where they go with Murdoch from there, maybe a heel turn, I don't know. And that was how the show ended. There was very little downtime between the matches, no video packages, so if you were not up to date on the feud, they didn't have any video packages to help you with that. It was very bare bones production-wise in that regard, but it also allowed the show to get over in a reasonable amount of time, so there's a give and take there. So that was the NWA When Our Shadows Fall pay-per-view on Fight TV earlier today. So happy to take your phone calls and emails on that show, on TakeOver, on any of the other big things happening in pro wrestling, a bit of a controversial Dynamite that happened on Friday night with a lot of people giving it a thumbs down. You can reach us 515-605-9345 to call. Press 1 if you'd like to talk. Otherwise, you can email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. Got a couple emails to get to here today. So to join me in chronicling the TakeOver show, as well as other happenings in professional wrestling. For the first time, joining me here on Wrestling Night in America as a co-host, one of the newer members of the PWTorch.com family, contributor, Dr. Bruce Hazelwood, joining us. So, Bruce, welcome to Wrestling Night in America.
Thank you for having me, Greg. I really appreciate the invite, and I hope I can put on a better show than what many, that second hour of Dynamite. I hope I can do better than that, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to Dynamite in a minute. A lot to digest from that show, and a lot of people kind of writing it off as, oh, it was a Friday night show out of its normal time slot, 11 p.m. to midnight, but I don't see AEW as a sort of company that just sort of books throwaway shows because they don't think anyone's going to watch. And I think, you know, putting Andrade in there and debuting him tells you that the AEW didn't see it as a throwaway show. But I digress. Bruce, I know you were not able to watch the NWA pay-per-view. I don't know how familiar you are with the product or anything like that, but I just kind of wanted to throw it to you as we wrap up our When Our Shadows Fall discussion, unless there's a call or email about it. With I know you were tracking the results and reading the results in real time as it was going on. Just your impressions of the show from what you read.
So it seemed like a pretty good show by all accounts from what I was reading, what I saw online. The finish to the world title match seems to have rubbed some people the wrong way, and I had to reread it a couple times as I mentioned to you, just because I wanted to make sure I understood what happened. But I'm really excited to see what happens with both Serena Deeb and Camille, as you were talking about. And I saw some people mentioning that maybe this means Deeb signs full time with AEW. I'm not sure, but I think this opens the door for her to appear on other shows a little more. And Deeb, as you were mentioning, is a fantastic wrestler, and any match she can have on television, national television, anywhere, is not only a boon to her, but her opponent as well as the promotion she'll be in. So I'm also interested to see Camille, because many people were, when NWA first rebooted and Camille was brought in as Nick Aldis's kind of manager, many people were not skeptical, but they were wondering what her in-ring would look like. And, you know, it was a great match from what I was reading and some of the highlights I saw. And I want to see if it's a byproduct of being in the ring with someone like Deeb, or if it's just a show of her growth and the potential that she displays. So that's the most interesting thing to me coming out of it. As you said, though, JTG, Fred Rosser, they looked fantastic coming into this. I mean, JTG hasn't looked this aesthetically, hasn't looked this good, I would say, I think, his whole career. So it was fantastic to see these kind of these character refreshes. They're the same people. We know who they are, but they've done things to reinvent themselves as the years have gone by so that we don't think of them in a certain light. And I really appreciate seeing the creativity from wrestlers in doing that.
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to mention is there was a time when you could sort of coast on the indies based on your WWE name value. If you had been there long enough, yes. If you had done enough in that company, and you could get out of shape and you'd still get paid and you'd still get the crowd pops of people just based on your name value. That's not really what the indies are about anymore. You know, the indies are about, can you hang with the best of the best? So if you're somebody like a JTG or a Fred Rosser, you know, just the fact that you were in WWE isn't going to get you booked in really prominent places anymore. And so, yes. You know, to see them put the work in, obviously with working on their body and working on their in-ring, Fred Rosser is better now as an in-ring performer than he was in WWE. So to see guys like that continue to improve and earn spots like this on pay-per-view for places like the NWA, which, you know, it's not AEW or even necessarily Impact, but it's something. I think it's a really encouraging sign that they have that there, and they have a place to land that is visible and allows them to be seen and allows them to continue to work and improve.
And with NWA, I think because of their style, if you really just want to focus on showing and displaying your wrestling acumen, that's a great place to do it. Not to say that the promos aren't there, you know, those they're there, but the focus is more on sort of telling stories through the in-ring work in NWA. And so for wrestlers who might not have been known as great wrestlers in the past, such as Fred Rosser, it's a great place to be in terms of reconditioning people to what you can do and the potential you still have.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. One more thing before we go to the phones, and that's the finish of the main event. You know, we're in an era where WWE's finishes are, let's put it kindly, trash. I mean, constantly trash finishes. And AEW has gone down the path as of late having more interference in their matches, even if it doesn't necessarily lead to the finish, which I've noticed a lot is they do have interference. It may not necessarily lead to the finish, but it's still interference. And now NWA with this wonky finish in their title match, is this just the direction pro wrestling as a whole is going and we need to accept it? I mean, to me, this was an opportunity for the NWA to stand out as this discussion of bad finishes is happening in the two biggest companies in the United States. This was their opportunity to stand out. And really, I mean, Trevor Murdoch's great at what he does, but is he a guy who needs that protection? And maybe the argument is, hey, Nick Aldis is a heel. What's more heelish than a guy who can beat someone but still cheats to do it? But, you know, in the context of the larger picture of professional wrestling, it just leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth.
So I don't – I'll say that it's likely that the majority of professional wrestling in the U.S. that you will see will be like that. But when I look at MLW and Ring of Honor, for instance, I don't necessarily see them as engaging in this as much as WWE and more so AEW Impact and now with NWA. I think we also have to take a step back and realize that because of WWE's essential monopoly the last two decades, a lot of wrestlers now who are on in different promotions, whether it's NWA, Ring of Honor, AEW, were also trained in WWE. So I was bringing up a couple weeks ago with Zach Hadorn on the Raw Post show that, you know, Adnan Burke, I have a broadcasting degree from Washington State University, which their broadcasting school is named after Edward R. Murrow. So we're trained a specific way in broadcasting and in sports broadcasting, and to expect someone to be able to lose all that and be quick to go to a new thing right away is a bit farcical, in my opinion. So I was trying to caution people, you know, the next day he parted ways. But that's kind of what I think we need to do here is that sometimes it's hard to lose the thing that you've been trained with so much. And in WWE, you get trained in a certain style and you're trained to have certain kind of matches so much that even if you have a certain vision, it's hard to kind of get out of that tunnel of this is how it's supposed to be done because this is how the largest promotion does it.
Yeah, it's that sort of wrestling bubble that people get stuck in. An outsider like Billy Corgan, he was seen often as an outsider when he came into Impact and things like that, even though he's got pretty extensive experience in professional wrestling by this point. So, yeah, you look at the NWA and you think of more old-fashioned and the studio setting and the clean finishes, but we didn't get that in the main event. So let's go to the phones. Got the 814 area code. This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland up first. Ryan, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first topic for us tonight?
Yeah, first question is on John Cena. Could you ever see him doing the Sergeant Slaughter gimmick and maybe siding with a different country since he knows a foreign language now?
Oh, boy. I don't think so for two big reasons. I don't see that because it would hurt his image as an actor, and that's really – he's an actor first right now, and a wrestler maybe, I don't know, second, third, or fourth in his life right now. If he was still a full-time guy, maybe we could have that conversation. But with what he's doing and with his profile in Hollywood, I don't think he would want to take that risk. And, you know, the second thing is – I don't, you know, it's related to the first thing is I don't think he would be on TV often enough to really, you know, that's a story that you've got to tell over multiple weeks and even months. The why, the what's going on behind the scenes, you know, that's that sort of thing in storyline. And I don't see Cena being around long term enough for them to really tell that story in a meaningful way. And so, you know, this is a guy who's been babyface for a long time. We've always talked about John Cena turning heel. If he did turn heel, Bruce, this wouldn't be the heel turn that I would expect of him or would have ever expected back in those days where, you know, the main topic of conversation amongst fans of WWE were, when is John Cena going to turn heel?
Well, and if he did turn heel this way, he'd actually have more fans than Western fans because there's way more people in China, mainland China, than there are in the West. So who would it be a heel turn to would be the question. But even if he was around for that long, there's two things I wanted to add to that. Even if he were around that long, one, I guess the two things coalesce. One, WWE's booking especially the last year or so, isn't in a space where we can tell that story. And I think because of that, it makes this kind of gimmick a mid-card gimmick. And I don't think John Cena is someone who, even at this stage of his career, is going to come back and do a mid-card gimmick. So while it's intriguing because of, you know, the apology he sent out in Mandarin the other day about Fast and Furious, and or not about Fast and Furious, but about the promotion leading up to it and how he said that, was it Taiwan, I think, was the country. It's an intriguing bit to go down in terms of fantasy booking, but I don't think, you know, he's all about that money right now, and the best way to keep that money is to make all parties happy, and you're not going to make all parties happy doing this, even if it's kayfabe.
Yeah. I agree on that one. Ryan, back to you for your second question for us tonight.
Okay, second question is on Austin Idol. Do you think with Vitaly Blanchard making a return to the ring could mean that maybe the NWA will try something similar with a tag team match with him and Tyrus wrestling?
I didn't really get a sense that that is a direction they're going. I think the meet up with Tyrus is relatively recent because I think Idol was just on commentary at times on the last pay-per-view they did. So somewhere between there and here, I guess he's joined forces with Tyrus. You know, I don't know what kind of physical condition Austin Idol is in. I would not rule out any kind of match, even if he can only throw a punch. You know, they can do enough to disguise any kind of weakness. He doesn't have to even do as much as Tully Blanchard did when Tully returned to the ring in AEW. I go back to my joke earlier, he might be able to do more than Tyrus, to be honest with you, at this stage. But, you know, Idol is one of the more fun, I think, characters in NWA from what I saw of him, you know, doing the ads when they were still on YouTube last year. Or the year before, whenever that was, all the years are starting to run together at this stage. You know, so I wouldn't rule it out. You got to find a situation where it makes sense to. You know, right now it looks like Tyrus is going to get an opportunity to take on the Pope for the TV title. I don't know if the Pope would have someone have his back or what storyline that could lead to. Perhaps, given that Idol helped Tyrus get the victory here, maybe Pope would want someone to watch his back and building to a Pope Tyrus TV title match, you'd have Austin Idol and someone against the Pope and someone. But, you know, what do you think about Austin Idol returning to the ring and joining forces with Tyrus, even maybe a one-off, Bruce?
I can see it happening. Like you said, they could definitely help mask some things in the studio setting. Kind of does help in that terms of the way that they can edit the video. But I think NWA is best served to keep Idol and kind of the managerial role and have him on the mic. You know, anytime he can speak, it just brings more energy and more kind of invigoration to the show. And I think that's the best role to have him in. Now, again, they could still have that match, but depending on what they do, they could really either enhance him real quickly or lose that luster very, very quickly. So, and especially if Tyrus is his partner, like you said, he really can't move around no more. And he really couldn't move around that much to begin with, but now his mobility is very, very limited. And I don't think you want to put him in there as with a partner whose mobility is that limited, because that would
make
it harder to mask his age and his skill deficiency now because of the age.
That's a good point as well. Ryan, back to you for your third and final question for us tonight.
Yeah, I went to a wrestling match last night, and there was a wrestler on that show that's, they claim to be 7 feet tall, Ben Bishop, and there's a picture of him and Kevin Nash together, so it does look like he is pretty close to 7 feet tall. Do you know if any other giants on the independent circuit of that height?
They have gotten more and more rare, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be, you know, if, and the problem too, being on the independents and being that size, is if you are that size, chances are WWE is going to snap you up, because they, as we see with Omos and things like that, they've expanded the type of wrestler that they're looking for over the last 20, 25 years, but they're still a big man territory. If you're the size of Omos, they're going to find room for you. They're going to find something for you to do. So I don't know of anyone, but that's partly because the attraction factor makes it such that a WWE, maybe even an AEW, we don't really know what they're looking for yet in talent, in terms of would they take someone that size just to have them on the roster, just to have someone different on the roster like that. But usually they get snapped up very quickly by WWE.
Yeah, and I don't know of any people who are that height on the independent scenes, but what I've noticed is that while the independent scenes have always been known for having sort of the Adam Cole types, I'm seeing a lot more muscular types who can also go in the ring. I think of Alexander Hammerstone as the perfect example here in MLW. That dude is incredibly, incredibly muscular and ripped, yet he can do things in the ring that just wow you for someone that size and that muscularity. So I think that you see more of a shift towards that. Like Parker Boudreaux, before he was signed by WWE, was in that mold as well. And so that, less height and I think more size is what we're seeing in the independent scenes, a shift towards that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hammerstone also posted a picture on Twitter yesterday of, he says,
God,
I baked Pop-Tarts inside cookie dough, inside brownies with Oreos. So if you've ever wanted to see what that looks like, goodness, that looked delicious. That's probably something you could only eat once in your lifetime. I don't think that's something that's healthy enough for you to eat more than once. So eat it to try it, maybe, but that's about it. Ryan, thank you for the phone call tonight. Look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Okay. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks, Ryan.
Absolutely. So let's get to TakeOver next week.
Mm-hmm.
On the Peacock, for those of us here in the States anyway. Four matches announced so far. We do have one episode of NXT that could change things and add some more matches to that show. I want to start with Xia Li versus Mercedes Martinez. I've been effusive in my praise of the Tian Sha storyline, Xia Li's work, Boa's work even, although not in-ring work because he hasn't really wrestled yet, but just the character work that he's done. And, you know, I know that it's not a storyline that everybody's going to like, but they've been off TV for a while. So this seems like an opportunity to heat them back up as Xia Li takes on Mercedes Martinez, coming off of a loss, a big loss recently, challenging for the NXT Women's Championship. So, you know, it's hard to see them stopping whatever momentum they want to pick back up with Tian Sha and Xia Li, but you also don't want to – I mean, Mercedes Martinez has a really great look, and you don't want to, I don't think, define her down by having her take another big loss. So you look at this match – and who do you see coming out on top here?
And, you know, since Mercedes Martinez lost to Raquel Gonzalez, they've looked her strong. So it makes it even tougher to gauge what they should do here. I think that they'll have Xia Li go over. But I think what should happen is that Li loses through overconfidence or not following the instructions of Mei Ying. And because of that, suffer some kind of physical punishment that really just, because like you said, they haven't really been as consistent on TV, that really reignites kind of what they're about to the fans who are watching, especially now that you're going back to having fans inside the arena to be there live. Mm-hmm. I think this would be a great way to get the fans who are watching, especially if they're going to be attending the shows, to be like, oh, that's right, this is what they're about. Well, in terms of WWE doing sort of the supernatural or some or more kind of they're both kind of storylines, for more or less better terms. This is one of the ones that have actually done a pretty good job of kind of the mysticism behind Mei Ying and the whole group Tianxia. And I think probably just due to being on NXT, and you kind of see some of the differences there. But I think this is a good model for WWE to use when they want to go into sort of these kind of storylines. Because, you know, I cover Raw for the Torch, and the Alexa Bliss and The Fiend last year, has the storyline between them and Randy Orton and everybody has just been kind of muddled and convoluted, and you don't really know what's going on. It doesn't really make much sense here and there. And so I think this could be the model they use as how kind of the skeleton of how they should book these sorts of storylines.
Yeah, the other thing I'm looking at from more of an in-ring point of view is, ever since her turn, Xia Li has upped the aggressiveness of her in-ring persona. And we know that Mercedes Martinez, her whole style is built on aggression. So how these two mesh in the ring is really going to be fun to see, especially because Xia Li, since this turn, has not really had any long competitive matches. I mean, she's had a couple of squashes to get over this mm-hmm. persona, but I don't think she's faced anyone the caliber of Mercedes Martinez. So just from an in-ring point of view, it's going to be interesting too.
Well, we were talking about Serena Deeb earlier. Who better for Xia Li to kind of test her mettle against than Mercedes Martinez, the living legend, one of the mm-hmm. best women's wrestlers in the past 20 years. So this would be a very interesting match, like you said, for the in-ring. I hope it turns out to be more like a Sheamus Drew McIntyre hard-hitting match, and one that's less sloppy.
Yeah. One of the other matches on the undercard is L.A. Knight versus Cameron Grimes. Both of these men have been fighting over the affection of the million-dollar man, Ted DiBiase, of late. And so I'm going to let you take the lead on this one first, because I'm mm-hmm. such a Ted DiBiase mark that I cannot be objective in my in my analysis of this storyline. So tell me honestly how, and if you're harsh, it won't hurt me. Tell me what you thought about the involvement of Ted DiBiase into this Cameron Grimes character, where, you know, he became rich overnight, I guess, and was kind of throwing money away for a while. And then somebody richer than him comes up, and now Cameron Grimes appears to be a babyface, or at least on his way.
Yeah, so I was born in 88, so I missed the heyday of Ted DiBiase, right? I think I could be pretty objective here, and I still love DiBiase, right? And go back, and his character work was just fantastic. I've loved this storyline. Has it been hyperbolic at times? Yeah. Does that work here? Yes, because all three of the characters now are those characters who, you know, those people in real life who are just over the top, and that's them, and it works because they are that over the top. As you said, Cameron Grimes is now a face. They've done a fantastic job in the subtle turn to make him a face with the insertion of Ted DiBiase and then LA Knight. So they did a really, really good job here by not making it so sudden and so direct that you're just like, oh, okay, cool. You've kind of gone on that journey with him to want him to root for him to take out Knight and to take out DiBiase or you know, win the services of DiBiase, however you want to look at it. So they've done a really good job there. So LA Knight to me is an act already tailor-made for Raw, and I think he'll be there sooner rather than later. So I don't think he goes over here. And I think his whole time on NXT has been booked perfectly because, you know, initially he's not winning his matches and he still hasn't won very many, but he's someone whose cockiness and arrogance is such that it's okay for him to lose because he doesn't realize how bad he is, and that's fine. That's that character, right? And so I think here Grimes should go over. What that means with DiBiase, I'm not sure. There's rumors that the Million Dollar Championship is back now. I love that title. So if he goes over here, sorry, I just got lost thinking about the title. If Grimes goes over here, I think it will be hard for DiBiase to deny him not just a partnership, but to that $1 million championship, which goes along with Cameron Grimes being a millionaire until he found out there's multimillionaire like DiBiase, right? So I think it would be a great, it would be great because it would satisfy Cameron Grimes' need to be noticed as a millionaire and to be praised, but also help DiBiase because he knows he's got more than that. And just appeasing Grimes here is all he needs to do. So I think it works at multiple levels.
Okay. I like it. Raquel Gonzalez against Ember Moon. The NXT Women's Championship is on the line here. Going to be a unique match. Raquel Gonzalez, we've talked a lot about her improvement over the last couple years, paying off in an NXT Women's Championship title run. So my interest isn't so much in either Raquel Gonzalez or Ember Moon for the sake of this question. It's about Dakota Kai, who has sort of been riding the coattails of Raquel Gonzalez lately. At what point do you think Kai gets tired of that and maybe turns on Raquel Gonzalez? We've seen some babyface hints dropped over the last few weeks about Raquel Gonzalez, although she's always seemed to come back around to being a heel. If Kai turns on her, one would think Gonzalez would be the babyface, Kai being the heel. Or maybe it goes the other way. Maybe, you know, right. Kai tries to help Gonzalez and Gonzalez loses or something and Gonzalez gets tired of her and turns on Kai. I don't know. But how long are we waiting, do you think, for Dakota Kai to challenge Raquel Gonzalez or be in line for that NXT Women's Championship?
You know, if Kelly Wells had booking power, Dakota Kai would have been women's champion from the minute she walked into the NXT doors. So if you have Kai turn on Gonzalez, the interesting thing here is it's more difficult in professional wrestling to make the larger wrestler the babyface to the smaller heel. When we get to Adam Cole and Karrion Kross, you know, they're doing that here, but an even starker contrast between Gonzalez and Kai. So if they do go down that route, I think it'll be fine, though, because, as you said, they have been leaning Gonzalez more face, and Kai was good as a face. She's always been great as a face. But this heel character has just been so much more engaging and interesting to me. So I think they maintain this route. What I want to guarantee here is that there will be some kind of interference, distraction, because Dakota Kai's going to be there, Shotzi Blackheart's going to be there. We're going to see something happen where WWE, as you said, they're going to go to some kind of trash finish, and you know, maybe what happens here is Kai helps Gonzalez and Gonzalez wins, but after the match, Gonzalez doesn't acknowledge that, and then Kai gives her those big kicks to the face, the running kicks, and then lays her out, and we have your next feud for the next takeover. Because I think Gonzalez should hold on to the title until at least the next takeover. You can have it, lose it there. And I think she should lose it to Kai. I wanted Mercedes Martinez to be women's champion, but it was way too soon in Raquel Gonzalez's title run after all that buildup for her to have lost it. So I think all storylines, unless Xia Li wins and goes on a streak and they want her to be the next one to challenge, I think what they should do is Gonzalez, Kai, next takeover, Kai defeats Gonzalez, finally becomes women's champion, Kelly Wells to celebrate.
Are you surprised it's Ember Moon getting the title shot here? You know, she and Shotzi Blackheart have been so invested in the NXT women's tag titles. There are a lot of deserving women in NXT who could easily be put in this spot. Does it feel like they've taken a bit of a left turn with Ember here out of nowhere for her to get this title shot after chasing the tag titles and being a part of that scene for so long?
If you just look at it and right away, yes, you could say that. But when you look at how the women's division has been booked since the last takeover, Martinez has been involved with Tian Shao, right? Zoe Stark and Toni Storm had their little thing. You have more tag team matches going on. There's really no one left, I believe, unless I'm missing someone, that really not just could say I'm going to be the contender, but have some kind of credibility to assert that. Ember Moon not only has the credibility as the is she a current women's champion, tag team champion? I can't remember. No, I think they lost it. Yeah, Indian Heart, the way of it. Mm-hmm. Right. So she was most recently a women's tag team champion, but like Finn Balor, she is a former NXT champion, and she left, and now she's coming back to try and retain or to reclaim that title. So the storyline is all there. And it works in that regard, especially because, again, if you look holistically at how the women's division has been booked, I don't think there's really anyone else you could have turned to in this regard. It helps that the story of Ember trying to become a women's champion again in NXT is there, because that gives you more of an investment to maybe think that, okay, it might happen. It could happen. At least there's some reason she's in this match beyond they just need another challenger. So this is one of those things where they're doing so much trying to build the other stories within the women's division, they kind of forgot about the women's championship picture, which is both a testament to the depth of their women's roster, but also they need to be able to focus on the top title, right? So it'll still be a good match. I don't think this is when Ember Moon reclaims that title.
And the NXT title is on the line in a fatal five-way match. Karrion Kross versus Adam Cole versus Kyle O'Reilly versus Pete Dunne versus Johnny Gargano. Fitting a lot of main event names into that match, Bruce. What's your take on the structure of the match, the five-way match, as opposed to doing another one-on-one match? You know, there's been talk amongst a lot of people that Kross is not fit from an in-ring standpoint to be NXT champion. And you know, his match with Finn Balor at the last TakeOver notwithstanding, or on TV rather, notwithstanding. Is this a way to kind of disguise his limitations, or is this just kind of standard WWE booking to put the champion at risk?
Both. It could be both. And I think it is both. And the issue here for me with Karrion Kross is when you put him in this kind of match, you are signaling to your fans, regardless of what you're trying to do, that you don't trust him to carry a main event singles match for the title. If the plan is for Cole to go over, I would have just trusted Kross and Cole to go out there one-on-one and for Cole to be able to carry him, or at least ring general him, to a good match, just like Finn Balor and Karrion Kross had not too long ago. I think this is just way overbooked. How they got here, I think, is a bit overbooked, because it was a triple threat match initially to determine the number one contender, the Adam Cole crash last week. And for your main men's championship, you can't have this sort of lack of focus and this sort of, to use a Zach Hadron word, sort of manic nature to how you're booking these things. I would have much preferred a singles match, even if that singles match wouldn't have been a five-star or four-star match, right? This is your main men's championship. I think if it's a triple threat match, I think it has less of a diminishing factor. But once you make it a fatal four-way and then a fatal five-way match, I think it just has too much of a diminishing factor there for me to be like, this is going to be – look, it'll probably be a fine match, but there's going to be too much suspending of reality for me to be able to fully invest in the match, because that's how WWE books these multi-person matches. So who they decide to have come out as champion in this match is going to be an inflection point for NXT on what they want to do for the next 3 to 6 months. If they keep it on Cross, then they're okay with how he's performing, with his promos, with his in-ring work, to the extent that they believe he can still be champion. If they put it back on Cole, I think it's a signal that they're worried and they want someone that that's proven and reliable, that can carry the brand, can carry the championship. If they go with O'Reilly or Dunn or Gargano, then at least it'll signal that, even with Gargano being a former champion, it'll signal that there's something different coming with NXT. So, again, I think I'm more interested in actually what the end of the match than I am in the match itself.
Do you believe it's either Cole or Cross here for the win?
I think it's Adam Cole is the favorite, and then Karrion Kross and everyone else. I think after those first two, it's a pretty steep drop. Mm-hmm.
This is Wrestling Night in America for June 6, 2021. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, joined by PWTorch.com contributor Bruce Hazelwood, as we run down the big shows in pro wrestling here. 515-605-9345 is where you can call us up. WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can send the email. So with that said, let's go back to the phones. The 305 area code, DJ from Miami. DJ, welcome to Wrestling Night in America this week. What's your first question for us?
Before I start my questions, Mayweather or Paul?
Oh, come on.
Mayweather, I guess, right? I mean, has he ever lost at anything, ever?
No. It's Money May easily. As much as I have to test the man, it's easily him.
Okay.
I guess I'll start with WWE because you guys are talking about NXT. I don't know what's going on, but I feel like if Brock Lesnar's going to come back, I feel like he should go through Bobby Lashley, not Roman. I feel like they should have, like, John Cena or somebody like that for Roman. Anybody else, just that Brock. I feel like almost should go with Lashley so he has somebody, the two guys to teach him, you know, and maybe he can talk, you know, and get into this thing and then let Brock Lesnar go through him. So it's not just a rush thing. Okay, that's it, run and done, you know, so it will just pull out a little. And, you know, so, you know what I mean? I feel like that compared to, like, going for Roman and where are they going to go after that? You know what I mean? At least this storyline will at least, you know, fold out a little, you know. Him trying to go through almost and almost, you know, trying to get a better on him, maybe. You know what I mean?
Well, let me see if I can pick some pieces out of there, Bruce. Let's start with Lesnar. If he does return, Lashley or Reigns, I think you could make an argument for either one of those. Who would you prefer to see? Would you rather see Lesnar come back and face Lashley or Reigns?
Who would I prefer? Lashley.
Yeah.
Who do I think WWE would go with? It's Roman Reigns. Both had a storyline reason, right? Lashley and Lesnar,
yep,
was supposed to happen in the mid-aughts, and it never happened. But the more intriguing and more dynamic story is the Paul Heyman thing. And so I think that is too enticing to pass up if he comes back. Because if he comes back, you're not going to hold off that story until later. It needs to be immediately with Brock Lesnar. As you said with John Cena, he's not going to be around for the long run, right? He's going to come do his thing and disappear for however long, right? Him and Roman Reigns makes more sense, with this, even with the other story from Lashley, because of the Paul Heyman dynamic that you just don't have with Bobby Lashley.
Yeah, I think the Paul Heyman angle is one that would be almost too good for WWE to pass up. I think when you compare that to, you know, the past history that was just missed out on by not doing Lashley versus Lesnar before, or, you know, their amateur credentials or whatever the case may be, however you want to set that up, I think it's an easier story for WWE in their creative process to tell the story of Paul Heyman, which side does he choose, that sort of thing. I think, yeah, I agree. I think Lashley Lesnar it's more unique. We've not seen it before, and there are not a lot of top guys in WWE that you can bring Lesnar back to face that he hasn't faced before.
Yes.
So I think the uniqueness of that match also makes it stand out in my mind anyway. DJ also brought up the potential of Omos going against Lashley. We know that he's one half of the tag champion, so he does have some credibility within the WWE Universe storytelling to get a title shot at some point soon. You know, we've seen that WWE has not been averse in the past to taking giants like Omos and pushing them beyond their skill level. And so, you know, do you foresee, you know, and maybe even in the next 3 to 6 months, WWE wanting to pull the trigger on an Omos versus Lashley match, knowing that if they wait too long, Omos will likely get exposed in the ring, and they want to do that match quickly before that happens?
Just so I'm clear, DJ, were you saying that Omos should be paired with Lashley or face Lashley?
One or the other, I was saying. Like, I would like
okay,
for
one
him
the
to
other.
Be with him, too. Yeah, one or the other.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, you know, the tag team championship right now, that dynamic is a hurdle they'd have to overcome sooner rather than later if that were the case, because I think this is a match. If you do Omos and Lashley, that's something for SummerSlam, the spectacle of it. And, wow. I know what they see in Omos because I've seen it too, but when I've seen him in the ring, it's just, it's not as what I hoped for. And Lashley is a good wrestler, but his style isn't one that would, you know, necessarily help Omos look better in the ring, I believe. Lashley is someone who I think has his best matches with those who are more snug, like Sheamus and McIntyre, and those who can create a lot more movement, like a Cedric Alexander or Shelton Benjamin, for example. So if we had to choose, I'd say if he loses the tag titles, have him turn on Styles, lay him out with the big chokeslam or whatever it might be, and then have Lashley and MVP watch from the stage and kind of nod along, and the next week you have him then approach him and he joins and go from there. And I think what works for Lesnar is Lesnar's all about suplexes. And what better spectacle than seeing Lesnar suplex a 7'3" dude over and over again to get to Lashley, if you have him go that route. So if we have to choose between these options, I'd say pair him with Lashley and MVP, have him take the loss to Brock, you know, while learning along the way, and then that would be how I go. But I don't – I think that would be not a good route for them to go either way.
If you are intent on replacing, if you're MVP storyline-wise,
yeah,
and you want to replace Cedric Alexander and Shelton Benjamin, what better way to replace them than with Omos? You know, go the complete opposite route than what you had with them. And I think you're right. You know, Omos versus someone singles for a title could work if you're somebody like Daniel Bryan who can sell,
mm-hmm,
and whose strength is selling and almost can throw around. Lashley's not that guy. You know, that's not Lashley's strength. And when you have someone as limited with Omos as you do with Omos, it's going to be a very big styles clash. DJ, back to you for your second question or comment for us.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, because, you know, the choo-choo train's gone, so they need, you know, a new giant. So that's what I was asking, you know,
yeah,
either or. So my next thing, I guess we'll turn the channel to EAW. Okay. I've been telling you over and over about this. Velvet, red velvet, almost got splat velvet. Did you see what happened? Her legs went over her. That wasn't cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she could have really hurt herself. Then she jumped up like nothing happened. Like, I don't know if she just did, like, she just, like, you know, like a vault, like she had to, but, like, that looked like it was dangerous. Just like Pac. I love Pac. Pac doesn't have to sit there and do crazy stuff on the apron. That is not cool. You know, somebody like that can get hurt, and he's a good player in that game. You know, he can go up in the ladder. You know, I don't know why they're doing this. They need to stay more in the ring. They got to go back to the old school. I don't know what they're doing. These guys are really going to hurt themselves.
Well, I mean, I think if you looked at the injuries, yes, Red Velvet's dive was certainly scary. But I think if you look at the injury list of AEW versus WWE, I don't know that AEW's has been significantly longer. You know, I think, look, I as a fan, some of these moves, Bruce, look dangerous to me, and
mm-hmm,
I hold my breath on them. But I'm not a trained wrestler. I don't know the secrets and the tricks to do these things to avoid injury. I'm putting my trust as a viewer in the wrestlers that what they're doing is safe enough to where they are comfortable doing it. The wrestler on the other end is comfortable taking it. The people in charge are comfortable with them doing these things. So I think at some point we do as fans kind of have to sit back and say, okay, you know, some of this stuff looks dangerous, but these are trained professionals who are wrestling at the highest level in the world. Maybe they know a little bit more about this stuff than I do.
Yes, to a certain extent, of course, that. You know, there are also scary dives in WWE, but what I will give WWE credit for is they tend to make sure that those can be as safe as possible. You know, in AEW, everyone turns back to the Matt Hardy incident. Because that was really bad. And what I've mentioned before is that there just needs to be, and I think, you know, Wade mentioned this a bunch of times too, is that they're lacking someone or at least a group to kind of give that quality control of what shouldn't happen. But, you know, I'm not going to just blame up AEW here because WWE has their number of unnecessary and dangerous dives and high-risk spots as well. The apron spots, they look great, right? You know, I'm not trained again, but the amount of people, especially who have wrestled in Japan, who have lingering and sustained neck injuries because of these apron spots over and over again leads me to believe that those are very dangerous and shouldn't be done. And yet we're seeing those more and more, and we're seeing more and more dangerous things happening on the apron. It's not just taking someone's leg off from under them. We're seeing like Death Valley drivers. We're seeing suplexes. We're seeing things like that on the apron, which are very visually, they look great. But I can just imagine the damage you're doing because you have planks of wood underneath there, right? So, and it's the hardest part with the corner of the wood there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an entire industry kind of thing.
Yeah, and the other thing I'll say is AEW kind of prides itself on being where you can see this kind of athleticism and these crazy moves that you don't see in WWE, that you don't see in NWA, that you may not even see in Impact. So, you know, part of the allure of the AEW product is to see some of the most talented athletically wrestlers in the world. I do agree about the apron spots. I think that not even from a danger point of view, but just from overdoing it. You know, it's kind of like when WWE gets in the habit of doing the spear that breaks the barricade or, you know, breaking the tables at ringside. Sure, it looks great, but the more you do it, the less impact on the viewer it has. So if they pulled back on those apron spots just from that, then the side effect is going to be you're not putting the wrestlers at risk as much either for debilitating neck injuries that you talked about from Japan. So, you know, if they did that, it would be two positives to come out of that for sure.
Well,
DJ,
you bring up a good point about how the shows brand themselves too, because that's how AEW brands themselves. MLW brands themselves as more like gritty and realistic. Ring of Honor prides themselves and brands themselves as more of a technical wrestling brand. So it really does depend on you want to go into these shows remembering what they're known for and how they portray themselves, so that it's like going into a CZW show and expecting it to be technical wrestling or something like that. So just be aware of that as well.
Yep, DJ, back to you for your third and final question for us tonight.
I just want to pepper this in real quick. I didn't like what Sammy said. Like, I do 1,090s off my mom's roof. Like, he didn't have to say, like, I don't want kids to try that crap, you know what I'm saying, nowadays compared to, you know what I mean? Like, he could have said blah, 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 you know? I don't know what y'all thought of that real quick.
This was where
before
and
my
who?
Last question. Sammy, remember when he was talking with Jericho? He's like, back then I did like whatever 690s off my mom's roof when she told me to come off the roof. Like, you don't have to say that. Like, I don't want kids trying that. I don't know if you guys caught that or not. Real quick.
Yeah, I mean, you do, Bruce, have to be careful, I think, in how you portray, you know, your childhood dalliances, because. I don't know how prevalent it is these days, how often, you know, it used to be big when I was a kid. You know, everybody had their own backyard federation. I had, you know, I wrestled my friends on the trampoline. I just don't know how many kids do that these days either. But, you know, you always want to err on the side of caution if you're a company like AEW.
Yeah.
I was just asking
if you saw that.
I was one of those kids who wrestled my stuffed animals and pillows and stuff as a kid watching these on TV. So, you know, yes, as Sammy, you want to be a little more, and this isn't the first time Sammy's comments have gained some notoriety for wrong reasons, but you also can just look at what they do on their regular programming, and there's things that kids can replicate that are dangerous anyway. So I think it's a slippery slope argument, but I still understand the point. You just got to be better. You know, WWE does the whole thing about do not do this at home. Maybe AEW could be better about having those kind of things throughout the programming.
All right, DJ.
All right, my next thing, I guess we'll say on EW. Man, I don't know what is going on with Christian Cage. Like, I'm so confused. Like, he's so much better at heel, but I understand, like, he wants to help people, but he doesn't look like he's helping people. Like, this is making him look bad, like a low card. I don't know what they're doing with him. He's the best as a heel. Like, him and Cage to tag team and go all the way up or something. I don't know. Something is – he's not – I don't know what is going on with him. He said he was going to, you know, work himself up, but, you know, the ladder. But I don't know what the heck is going on. What do you think?
Bruce, I think it's fair at this point in Christian's tenure to kind of assess where he's been and where he is slotted in AEW. And I thought watching the Casino Battle Royal last week that he had a real chance of winning that match because of his previous interaction when he first came into AEW with Kenny Omega, who's the AEW champion. And, you know, you want to cash in on that name value of Christian before you define him down as a wrestler. And I think they're very close to doing that, but it went to Jungle Boy and Christian came in second. So, you know, he doesn't really feel like he fits in with AEW right now. I don't see him as a great fit so far. I'm wondering if the outwork everyone mantra is eventually going to lead to a heel turn where, and I think the loss to Jungle Boy in the Casino Battle Royal is a great example of him coming up just short. And, you know, him not living up to that outwork everyone slogan will get him frustrated and get him to taking shortcuts or whatever the case may be that leads to a heel turn. But what's been your assessment of Christian Cage in AEW so far?
It pains me to say it because I always liked Christian more than I liked Edge in AEW. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the build-up to his reveal. But also his outwork everyone model. I don't know about you, Greg. I don't know about you, DD, but when I hear people talk about, I just worked harder, blah, blah, I just want to throw my phone against the wall because working harder can lead to some different things. But, I mean, that's not the reason why these things, you know, why you're so successful necessarily. Most people, it's because they have talent. Most people, it's because they have some luck and things like that. Hard work can only get you so far. And for me, whenever I hear that as a justification, I just want to punch somebody in the face. Not you, of course, not useless. But so, and as you said, what better model for a heel to have than outwork everyone and then not outwork everyone to achieve your victories, right? That would be a great character quirk to have, especially because at this point, you know, I like you, thought that it was tailor-made for Christian to win last week, and Jungle Boy won. And great for Jungle Boy. You definitely see the potential and know he's going to be at the top sooner, probably next year or two. He's just his talk about Raquel Gonzalez's improvement. His improvement has been something to see as well. But he just hasn't – the investment in it isn't there. He hasn't drawn my attention when he's on the screen. It just it's more – bland than anything, and that's not what you want when you're one, you hyped him up so much, but also in terms of your direct he's from your direct competition. You signed him from your direct competition because they thought he couldn't go anymore, and it may be that they were right, and you don't want to have to admit that, but you know, the heel turn would be the best way to get them out of it, especially if he, as you said, starts being a weaselly heel and winning by underhanded tactics.
All right, DJ, appreciate the phone call this week. Look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Yep.
All right. I want to go to the emails, first email of the night here, and it'll lead off talking about our next segment here, Bruce. And this is from Roy from California. He says, "Hello, Greg. Must say I thought your Grizzlies would pull off the upset, but the future is bright for such a young team. My question is with Drew McIntyre. I know fans can be fickle, but do you think WWE having Drew keep challenging for the WWE title has caused Drew fatigue? We've seen this in the past with others, usually who Twitter and the internet don't like, but since Drew is liked, I wonder if it applies. I hope Lashley annihilates him and closes this feud out, as I feel it's hurt Lashley's reign more than helped it. I did want to see them face each other at SummerSlam as a big match, but I have no desire seeing these two face, especially since the formula with Drew matches are when he loses, it's either a dirty finish or a pass out. Still can't get over it taking three spears and Jay interference in his match against Roman to lose. Super Cena vibes in full effect." So, Roy, thank you for the email. Yes, the Grizzlies, I saw a bit of their first game against Utah, and I think the elimination game when they got behind really early, and I was like, eh, why bother? But, you know, even in those couple, you know, couple quarters of action that I saw that they have quite a good nucleus there, and they seem to be set. I don't think many people were expecting them to make the playoffs this year, so they may be a year ahead of their development, so that's really cool to see. As for the question, Drew McIntyre, yes, we have a contract signing. This Monday, Bruce, I know you are just so excited to be able to cover a contract signing for PWTorch.com in your Raw alternative report this coming Monday, but it is a contract signing with Bobby Lashley and Drew McIntyre. You know, I'm getting to the point where I'm agreeing with Roy, and I don't think it's anything Drew's doing. It's not, you know, his matches are really good, his promos are good. They just, there's not a lot of meat to the storyline. It's just like, oh, Drew asked for another match, Lashley gave it to him, that's it. There's not a lot of creative, quote-unquote, going into this match, and maybe they'll kick it into high gear here Monday with the contract signing, I don't know, but it does feel like he's kind of, you know, with Strowman out the door, he's kind of last man standing when it comes to babyface main eventers. You look around and you're like, okay, who else is Lashley going to go against? And Drew keeps getting shot after shot. So, you know, we're more than a year into Drew McIntyre as the top star in WWE's Raw brand. Are we hitting Drew fatigue? Are you hitting Drew fatigue, Bruce?
Well, real quickly, my Sixers lost game one at home today, so that was bad.
Ah.
Well, I hit Drew fatigue at WrestleMania, Greg, so welcome to the club.
Okay.
yeah, the thing is, I've been on record on multiple platforms on the Torch saying that I believe what should have happened is this was before they even had the matches between Kofi Kingston and Drew McIntyre, was that he lost to Lashley, boom, the triple threat is done at WrestleMania Backlash. Okay, now keep McIntyre away, have him win Money in the Bank, and hold that briefcase as a cudgel over both champions, both of whom he has legitimate gripes with. And I think that would have been a great character refresh to get people more interested in Drew McIntyre than having him just go back into another match, another feud with Bobby Lashley. I think they still could have gone that route had they had Kofi Kingston, the babyface, win on Monday night to face Lashley at, let's face it, a B-brand pay-per-view. It's not one of their top pay-per-views, so I'm in agreement that it's the what has hurt Lashley the most was breaking up the Hurt Business, but this constant feud with Strowman and McIntyre is just not been. I gave them credit when I was on Zach Hadorn's On the Canvas podcast that at least the feud between Lashley, McIntyre, and Strowman was based around the WWE Championship, which it so often is not in WWE, which is, you know, backwards booking. That being said, I'm just not interested in another Lashley McIntyre match. And granted, I'm sure it'll be a great match. 3 stars at minimum, probably be a hard-hitting, fun match to watch. I'm just not interested because, one, Lashley should go over, and if McIntyre goes over, I am not interested in him in another babyface title reign. So I hit fatigue a while ago. From what I've seen on Twitter and in the circles that I've discussed McIntyre with, a lot of people have also hit that fatigue level with him. A lot of it has to do with the fact that people wanted to see Kofi Kingston get that title shot again, and he didn't get it. So that it could be some residuals from that as well. But again, like you said, it's now 14 months or so of Drew McIntyre being your number one babyface on Raw and your number one sort of act. Sometimes you can have acts that long and not need any kind of refreshing, but I think in modern wrestling, you need to have more quirks and refreshing to your character than once every 15, 16 months.
I do wonder how much the Thunderdome, despite it being award-winning, apparently, I wonder how much the Thunderdome environment has hurt his aura over the last year plus in terms of, you know, versus being in front of a live crowd. Would we be less apt to poo-poo Drew at this stage if this run had happened in front of a live crowd? And also just how much the actual creative of Raw and how bad Raw has been lately has kind of brought him down with it. You know, I wonder if Raw was a better show around him, would we still be feeling the same way? So those are two things that are really outside of his control. They're just things around him sort of affecting and attaching themselves to our opinions of him maybe too.
That is a very, very good point. Raw has been a bad show, and the ratings from Monday indicate that. And having covered it since November, it's, that you get fooled by their one or good show they might have like a couple weeks ago, and it was just a lot of in-ring wrestling, and then they go back to having six distraction finishes on one night the next week. So it's just that booking does also play a part into maybe the fatigue factor in. The booking has not helped anybody outside right now, outside of maybe RK-Bro and Xavier Woods and Kofi Kingston. So it just hasn't been a good show.
In addition to Drew and Lashley's contract signing on Monday night, we have Shayna Baszler, who will appear on Alexa Bliss's Playground. And we have a tag team battle royal for a shot at the champions AJ Styles and Omos, Lucha House Party, Viking Raiders, Riddle and Orton, New Day, and T-Bar and Mace. So a couple things to look forward to Monday night on Raw. Don't forget to check out Bruce's Alternative Perspective Report.
Look forward to
along
it.
With
it yeah.
Look forward to doing air quotes. Yes, I use that phrase loosely when it comes to this stellar lineup of Raw happenings coming up on Monday night. So we'll head back to the phones here. The 478 area code, Durrell from Georgia joins us. Durrell, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. And what's on your mind tonight first?
First off, how you guys doing? And it's been a while, Greg.
Yep. Doing well. Thank you, Durrell.
Okay. Yep. And Bruce, how you doing tonight?
Doing well, man. It's been a while since we talked on the phone, too.
Yes, it has. Okay, I'm going to go back to the NXT show, and I'm going to ask you guys a question about that. Now, catch my train of thought. I heard you guys talking, and you was wondering who could come out winning that Fatal 5-Way. I still think Karrion Kross is going to win that Fatal 5-Way. I was thinking that this is the beginning of an introduction back to Adam Cole, because they frame Adam Cole as the guy who's over, who's more over than the title. Everybody in that match should want to take out Adam Cole, or going to try to take out Adam Cole after his actions from Tuesday and how he ran down Karrion Kross, which you could say to most people was a babyface way because he was telling everything that was wrong with Karrion Kross. And now nobody wants to win the title. I think everybody wants to be Adam Cole. And this is a more story introducing Adam Cole as the main protagonist in NXT. How do you guys feel about that train of thought coming from me and saying that this Fatal 5-Way is more about Adam Cole than the NXT title? And this is the beginning of a story to say how Adam Cole works his way back into winning the title, maybe in a singles matchup or something, and becomes the guy who's obviously bigger than everybody in that match and bigger than the title, somebody who can save and lift that title back up, which he should be a babyface anyway, but we'll talk about that later. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, certainly Cole, I think, is the biggest threat to Cross's title, as Bruce mentioned earlier, in that match. I think one of the things that we do have to remember, too, is there are reports that WWE, with the recent cuts, are looking to bring up NXT talent to the main roster. There were some scouts from the main roster in NXT this past week, potentially looking at people to call up. Karrion Kross, since he set foot in NXT with this character, people saw this as a character more designed for the main roster than for NXT. So I think a lot of people thought that his time in NXT would be short. Adam Cole is the opposite. You know, he's a guy who his NXT tenure is probably going to be the height of his WWE run. I don't see Okay, I think I'm back. Bruce, Durrell, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I don't know how much of how much you heard of my answer. Bruce, did you hear me pitch it to you for your thoughts?
No, I think it's been at least a minute or so that you've been gone.
Okay. So let me try to catch up. Let me try to catch up with my thoughts before I apparently got kicked off. So I was talking about Cole being the biggest star of the match, aside from Karrion Kross, about the reports that NXT is looking to send some wrestlers to the main roster. There are some scouts in NXT this past week from the main roster, looking at wrestlers who could be called up soon. And since the beginning of his time in NXT, Karrion Kross has been looked at as that guy who is whose persona, whose entrance, everything is made for the main roster, and the expectation was he'd have a short stay in NXT, whereas Adam Cole is the opposite. You know, he's a guy who people look at because of his size that could be an NXT lifer. And, you know, he's been out of the main event picture for a little while, but, and Bruce, this is what I wanted to pitch to you, is there risk of Adam Cole fatigue in NXT, similar to Drew McIntyre? Or has he been away from the main event scene long enough to where, you know, people will accept him back again as a main eventer, potentially as an NXT champion?
I don't think it's just that the fact that he's been gone for a bit. I also think it's just that his act was much more interesting and engaging than Drew McIntyre's has been. I think what really set McIntyre back for me is when he was such an ultra baby face that he was doing his countdown and being overly gregarious. And I just thought that was a bridge too far for a character like McIntyre, even as champion. With Adam Cole, there's that chance for fatigue, but he's also been one of the most interesting, not just champions, but acts in NXT the past several years. And I still think back to that promo he had with Arash Markazi, where he's sitting at poolside in all black in the sun, complaining about how hot it is and having to wait for the interview to happen. Like, there's just more layers to Adam Cole as a character that even if he does become champion again, I don't think it'll be a detriment to NXT as a whole. Like I said earlier, I think the odds are it's either Cole or Cross, and then everyone else is far back in terms of who will win the match. So I think Darrell could be right in that Cross comes out the victor. It all depends on how quickly they want to move Axe to Raw or SmackDown. You know, I brought up earlier LA Knight being perfect for Raw. I think Frankie Monet is another act that is perfect for Raw, and Karrion Kross is probably another act that's perfect for Raw. And that show being 3 hours is all the help it can get. Now, of course, once they get there, the booking's going to hurt them, but at least it'll be something new and something fresh. And Kross with Scarlett with that entrance, I think it'll draw a lot of interest from Raw viewers.
All right, Darrell, your follow-up on that and your second question for us.
Okay. Yeah, my follow-up on that. Yeah, Adam Cole being, first of all, everybody in that matchup, I feel like is not placed in the right place. I feel like, not everybody, but most people, like, I feel like Adam Cole should be a babyface. Karrion Kross should be a heel. Kyle O'Reilly should be a heel because that baby face ain't working for him. And what they let Adam Cole do is reach something that you don't let them do on the main roster. You don't let them just come out and talk and tell stories unless you Roman Reigns and you're able to go and do what he does and something like that. And I feel like all the promotions from just in the United States, period, should be more fair-based. Because I understand people learn the match qualities and stuff like that, the 4 and 5 star. But I'm thinking more or less 4 and 5 star, maybe 3 star, but you give me more stories in the ring, outside of the ring, that'll boost that 3 star into a 4 or 5 star. I feel like that's the best thing. And this goes into my next question. And I have one more after this. But based off of what I see with somebody like Roman Reigns and Jey Uso and Jimmy Uso and just the diabolical mind of this man and how he's going, and what I see in NXT and especially on Raw, the horribleness of Raw, seeing Juice here, they change and held up at on AEW at times and sometimes on MLW, but MLW do a little bit better off with storytelling. I feel like people should be more with the storytelling and less with the match quality. Even though most people who wrestle today are to give you a 3-star match on a regular, and they give you a 4 or 5, but it doesn't entice people into being into the match. You just watch the match. Oh, that was a great match, and you forget about it later because it's nothing that ties you into the match because the story be so horrible, and it doesn't tell you anything in the ring, and you have all the confusion with what they do outside. rare foolishness and the disqualifications and stuff. I'm asking you guys, should wrestling start going back more and emphasizing to the story? We know WWE needs to learn how to tell better stories. So should wrestling as a whole forget about the 5-star, 6-star matches, even the 4-star matches, and start telling more stories with the matches and more maybe 3-stars, but if you tell the story, and that can be to a 5- or 6-star match because of the story and having you into the match doing what they do today.
Bruce, I don't know if it's a coincidence that at a time when professional wrestling has perhaps its highest in-ring work across the board that it's ever had, that there is such a low ebb of interest across the board in professional wrestling. Does that support Durrell's point that the storytelling is more of what's drawing people in these days, and if the storytelling isn't good, no matter the match quality, people aren't going to watch? Obviously, 4- and 5-star matches have become almost the norm, and yet interest in the product has not increased. Although AEW has held steady, and they have where you could probably say is the most consistent in-ring work, high-level in-ring work of any of the major companies in America. So I think there's got to be a balance. You know, I don't want to cop out with this answer, but you've got to have good storytelling that interests people, and you've got to have really good matches. I don't think it has to be one or the other, and I don't think it should be one or the other. I don't think you need to sacrifice match quality for storytelling. And, you know, I think you've got to make sure you have the right guys telling the right stories that fit their characters, and that's the big thing is, you know, you see a lot of where WWE, especially storytelling, falls short is you have wrestlers saying things and doing things that are inconsistent with the character right. That we see on screen. And that's where the frustration comes in. So what's your take on Durrell's point on the kind of push-pull of storytelling versus, high-quality matches, and if the match quality may need to be sacrificed for the storytelling purposes these days?
If we look at the history of wrestling, the in-ring quality was never that great apart from individual technicians here and there. And what drew people to professional wrestling the last century has always been the storytelling. Regardless of how you feel about Hulk Hogan, there's that iconic, image of him after turning and going to the NWO of that old lady just yelling and screaming at him from the front row. But to your point, Greg, you can't always just be about the stories, especially when we've seen in WWE the past 2 decades, the stories aren't that great. They're not good. They're not engaging. That being said, there is an audience. There is a market for people who like to have those 4- or 5-star matches, the in-ring, the in-technicians, the submission-style matches, the grappling matches. You know, I'm someone who loves submission wrestling, who loves grappling. Bret Hart was my favorite growing up. I love Bret Hart because he was such a master technician. There needs to be a balance, but the thing is, so WWE's gone to both ends of the spectrum the last 20 years, but regardless of how good your in-ring work is, if the storytelling is not at worst just average and good, it doesn't matter how good your in-ring wrestling is going to be, because what has been proven to draw in professional wrestling has been the stories and not necessarily the matches, right? We go back to the Attitude Era, the biggest boom period in professional wrestling. You'd be lucky to get 1 3.5-star match a month. We're getting multiple 3-star matches a show a lot of times now. So there's a difference for sure, but I still think that storytelling is what draws people to the art form to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And Durrell, your follow-up and your final question for us tonight.
No follow-up on that. I feel like, yeah, we should go back to that. And I ain't saying just in the match quality, just lower it a little bit and put a little more focus on storytelling, which what we've seen on this Friday with Roman Reigns and Mysterios and the Usos. My question to you guys is, would this be something that go to Hell in a Cell? And I figure that this is a story. This is the story arc. This is the chapter more about Jey Uso than Roman or anybody else, and what he's going to do. And I feel like he's going to turn on his brother, because he can start by the looks that he's been given ever since his brother came back, and how he don't want to go back to being just another Uso. He want to be Jey Uso, main event Uso, and how this is going to make him break away from his brother, but also start the divide between him and Roman, because he's going to start feeling himself and start thinking that, yeah, I am main event Jey Uso, and I don't need to let nobody disrespect me. How do you guys think about that as a whole with the Mysterios? And are we going to see a Hell in a Cell match between them, or will we potentially see the turn of Jey against Jimmy and him becoming his own guy? And thank you for the call.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Darrell. I would love to see Mysterios versus the Usos at Hell in a Cell. I think that would be a good match, and it would be a fresh match in the tag division, which does not have a lot of teams in it, so you see a lot of the same matchups over and over again. You know, Bruce, when Jimmy Uso came back, I thought, ooh, here's an opportunity to tell Jimmy's story and tell the story of what Jimmy's been feeling on the sidelines. How does he fit in with Roman and Jey? Where does he align himself? What's his side? What's his thought on everything that's taken place since he's been gone? And what it's really turned into, and I think Darrell sort of was going down this path, was it's actually become more about Jey. Jimmy has put thoughts in Jey's head about Jey's role as, in the Roman Reigns story, in the head of the table story. And it is almost more about Jey at this point than it is Jimmy, whether it's Jey turning on Jimmy or Jey turning on Roman. Not so much Jimmy turning on Roman or Jimmy turning on Jey, because I don't think he's fully embraced Roman Reigns as the head of the table. So, you know, your thoughts on a potentially Usos Mysterio Hell in a Cell match, and what does Jey do?
Sure. If any tag team knows how to put on a damn good Hell in a Cell match, it's the Usos and the New Day. And you have the Usos in there with the Mysterios, who, you know, Dominic has been improving. He still needs some work, but a gimmick match is a great way to kind of hide that stuff. And then, to a certain extent, this kind of match will, for lack of a better term, give him some credibility with the more hardcore wrestling fans that, you know, he took some of those bumps. He paid his dues to a certain extent. I think the whole tag team situation with the Usos right now is just a detour on the eventual route. And I think the actual eventual path is that at SummerSlam, excuse me, maybe not SummerSlam, maybe the pay-per-view before that, but I think it's Roman versus Jimmy Uso for the Universal Championship. And so for several years, I've been saying that Jimmy Uso has singles push potential, like more than Jimmy. And yes, I was able to tell them apart even years ago. And I think people are starting to see that now. Even though it's about Jey in terms of what he'll do, I still think he's just a red herring to get to Jimmy versus Roman, because I think Jimmy is the more dynamic individual, the more engaging, the more interesting in terms of the energy and kind of the charisma that is exuded through the screen. I feel like Jimmy has always had a little more of that. And so I'm excited to see where this goes. And I think you see that in the promos too, because like you said, he's not fully invested with Roman. He understands to a certain extent why Jey is with Roman, but he also isn't naive enough to ignore the detrimental way that Roman is treating his brother. And those layers for me, while it does make Jey interesting, I still think it's meant for an eventual Jimmy versus Roman Reigns match, kind of how Reigns had to beat Jey to get him to come along and be a part of the family. This is probably how they get Jimmy to finally be like, all right, you're right. I can't beat you, so my plan doesn't matter because you're still the top and I'll be there. Or he gets so pissed he can't beat Roman that he doesn't join. Or Jey finally turns on Roman and causes Roman to lose the title to Jimmy Uso, which would be out of left field, yes, but it would be something different at least. And there would at least be that storyline built into it if Jimmy does happen to usurp Roman Reigns.
I get to give you a long-distance pat on the back for being able to tell the Usos apart from years ago. I covered SmackDown for the Torch, and the Usos were on SmackDown for a long time, and I, even writing the reports, I still couldn't tell them apart. So good on you for that. I think I've gotten to the point where I can tell them apart now.
To be fair, once they got the tattoos more and more, it made it easier because Jay is the one that has the cross on his right shoulder. And then even before that, Jay was always the one that had grills in his mouth and never smiled. And Jimmy was the one who always smiled and never had grills in his mouth. That's how I always told them apart.
Okay. That's smart. That's smart. speaking of SummerSlam, though, and I know you mentioned the possibility of Roman Reigns, Jimmy Uso at SummerSlam, our next email question deals with that exact subject. It's from Jack from Swansea, Wales. He says, "Hey, Greg, hope you are doing good. Pretty down on the product for the last few months, except for SmackDown with Roman Reigns. After hearing the news of SummerSlam being announced in Vegas for a big stadium show and the way things have been going storyline-wise, do we have the actual WrestleMania this year at SummerSlam? I've heard Brock Lesnar and John Cena are near certainties to be back next month as soon as crowds are back full-time. And pretty sure Becky Lynch has been ready to go since before WrestleMania. And Edge has apparently always had plans to take a few months off after Mania to come back for SummerSlam. I would say Edge against Seth Rollins, who will probably defeat Cesaro at Hell in a Cell and possibly be a contender for Money in the Bank winner. Reigns against Cena, which I think has the potential to be an outstanding build and a warm-up for Reigns before The Rock at Mania. Bianca versus Sasha in a big-time rematch. Lesnar against Lashley. And possibly Becky Lynch against Charlotte, who I think will win the title by SummerSlam. What do you think about these possible lineups, and will it be enough to garner some momentum going into the autumn? What potential matchup do you think is the biggest? Thanks, Greg. Stay safe. Jack A. from Swansea, Wales." Yeah, you know, Bruce, I think that lineup is really super strong. I think it's probably on the side of, I think it's on the generous side in terms of thinking that all of these stars will be back for the same show. I don't know that that's going to be the case. But if you have all hands on deck like that for SummerSlam, it's going to blow WrestleMania out of the water this year in terms of star power, and it is going to make it seem like a big deal. And I think those matchups do feel very strong and are a good use of each one of those wrestlers coming back. For Becky Lynch, I know we talked about, you know, Brock Lesnar coming back and who his potential opponents could be. But for Becky Lynch, for John Cena, for Edge, if they come back for SummerSlam, who do you think the best matchups are for them?
I think Edge and Seth Rollins makes the most sense because they have the story of Seth trying to or intimating that he was going to re-injure Edge's neck when he was trying to get the title shot from whoever it was at the time. When I can't remember exactly, it has been so long. But so they have that story built into it, though they would have to do a little bit of nuanced work to remind fans of that history. I think Becky Lynch, no-brainer. Raw needs her more than anything. She comes in. I think what you do for SummerSlam, and this is a recall to, I think it was 2018 SummerSlam, you have her go against Charlotte Flair, who is women's champion, and you have Becky Lynch, where she started that turn to become the man a couple of years ago at SummerSlam, kind of reassert her authority as the man by taking out the person who she couldn't take out at SummerSlam a couple of years ago for the Women's Championship on Raw. And that would immediately bolster that division, immediately garner interest again. Raw would have at least something to look forward to every week, if not just the first, the night after. So I think for Becky Lynch, that you just have to bring her back on Raw and have her win. Now for John Cena, because of earlier how I said the most intriguing matchup is Reigns versus Lesnar because of Paul Heyman, I don't want to see a Cena versus Reigns match, though I understand all the reasons why it's so appealing. What you could do is, again, it would take some nuanced storytelling, but when Lashley was brought into SmackDown, he was kind of brought in to not be the replacement, but one of the babyface acts to replace Cena once he went to Raw. That never really panned out, but you could kind of go along that storyline and be like, well, look at me now. I am, you know, Lashley, I'm the one who's holding down the floor. I'm the one who's carrying this company. Where have you been, Mr., you know, telling The Rock he was all about Hollywood? Look at you now, Mr. Hollywood, yada, yada, yada. So I think there's ways you can do that, but I honestly don't know if this is the right time to bring John Cena back as well. If you're not going to have him with Reigns, because, again, I think the Lesnar story is much more intriguing than the Reigns storyline, then I think you hold off and wait till WrestleMania with John Cena. I just don't see the rush or the need to bring him back, especially because his last couple of returns haven't been as exciting as one would anticipate.
Yeah. All right, let's go to our final phone call of the evening. It's the 419 area code. I believe this is Craig from Toledo. Craig, welcome to Wrestling Night in America.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
Well, I've been having such a hard time trying to get connected with you guys.
I see you constantly dropping off and coming back on and dropping off and coming back on. I'm like, uh-oh, Craig's having some issues.
Yeah, I had notes written down. Now they're gone. Yeah, everything's all to cock. Yeah. Ted DiBiase sucks, by the way.
Oh, that hurts my heart.
Whew.
I mean, I had someone had to say it. Right.
No one had to say it, Craig.
Yeah,
Craig might
have
himself a ban from Greg.
No, I love Ted DiBiase, but I wanted to jump back to what you guys said. That's fun. The music. I don't know how it was, like 2 weeks ago we talked about the music, Greg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to know Bruce, because this is Bruce Lee. PhD, he is someone I want to weigh in on this whole the music argument.
Okay.
How much would you pay for what to whom?
So for those out there who did not hear the original story 2 weeks ago, Craig, do you want to explain a little more about what Bruce is giving you here?
I don't want to go in depth as far as I did yet a couple weeks ago, because
I don't want you to either.
Was,
but just that
was
the very what Bruce is for those who didn't hear that explanation. Can you give us like the Cliff Notes version?
Bruce, what song would you like to hear your favorite wrestler come out to?
You know, it would never happen because I'm a real, people don't know, but I've said this before, like, I'm a real thug rap kind of guy, and that's not going to get played too much, you know, in WWE or anything, but if I had my, you know, just because it would work with his motto, I would say John Cena to Tupac's Can't See Me, just because it's too good to pass up. If I had to be serious, though, and look at someone recent, someone more new, that's tough. I'd say go back to Swerve having Shaka Khan. There we go.
I stand. Is it stand or stand? I stand that. I stand.
I don't know how much I pay for it, but let's just go back to that.
This is why I was really excited about you being on here today, Bruce. The Osaka thing, the Naomi Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping you would weigh in on that, and just because I know how you helped me in just talking to you.
Well, thank you.
Where do you? It's a hard question to ask. Do you think that wrestlers should be You know what, Bruce? Just talk about it, because you know what I'm going to ask. I just don't have the words to ask. Right? I've been drunk.
To your point about wrestlers, though, right? When the releases happened this week, earlier this week, I saw a couple of tweets mentioning, like, how much it feel for you to all of a sudden log on to Twitter and see everyone talking about how you were fired, right? Like, that has to take a mental toll. And to the Naomi Osaka thing, I should preface this by saying I earned my dissertation or my PhD by writing a dissertation on critical sport pedagogy, which is how to use sport to educate and analyze social issues like white supremacy, patriarchy, et cetera. So that's how I approach this, right? Naomi Osaka is a Black and Asian woman that is in a sport that is mostly white, covered by mostly white people, governed by mostly white people, rich white people. And what she was saying about mental health, I think people need to understand and look more into the details of what she's saying because I've heard that, yes, it could have been done better by both sides, especially on the side of the French Open and all of the majors in general, because they've just been very paternalistic in their responses and how they've approached this. But what she was saying is a lot of the questions that we, we as professional athletes, her, receive after matches has to do with all the negative aspects, what they need to improve, what they were thinking when this happened. And it doesn't happen, and it really puts them in a space to where all they're thinking about then are those negative things. And when you get into these cycles of negativity and the thoughts of always like, I should have done this better, I should have done that better, what could I have done here? Like that, again, it takes a toll. It weathers you. And so one thing that I try to separate when I look at, when I analyze wrestling is I try to make sure in my analysis that when I'm talking about these wrestlers, I'm talking about their characters and their portrayals and how they're booked and not about them as individuals, right? So we joke about how Dana Brooke flexes a lot and that's all she does, but I try to make sure that that's related specifically to the character of Dana Brooke and not her as an individual because, again, she's doing what she's being asked to do. And so on the mental health aspect, I think particularly as fans of a niche product like wrestling, we can tend to be not just gatekeepers, but also very overzealous in our consumption, in our analysis, in our critiques. And I think it would do a lot of people better if they could approach these things and spend more of their focus, I guess, on the promotion and on the institution as a whole, and rather than looking at individual wrestlers and say, oh, their character, or, you know, they're a bad wrestler, but they shouldn't do this. There's time and space for that, but as a whole, I think the mental health of not just fans, but also the wrestlers would be heightened and have a more positive effect if we get away from hyping on individual wrestlers and all their faults all the time. We can critique because we want to see better, but how you critique is also a part of the equation that we, including us as those who cover the shows and the sport, we also need to understand and think about how we cover the sport, the language that we use, kind of the tone that we use, et cetera. And so it's a complicated but necessary discussion that we could have like a whole year of podcast on and still not really have a distinct or clear answer to. But I think there are steps that we can all take to make it better for all of us. And I hope that that helps answer part of what you're trying to ask, Craig.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and also I want to get to Greg on this, but like you identified that there is no answer, Greg. In covering this, and you, like we always joke that you're the psychologist of all of us who are upset or whatever on Sunday night. I forget what the hell I called you before, but you're basically our soothsayer. You're not a soothsayer. What the hell? That's a bad.
I like soothsayer. I'll take that, Craig.
What's going on March 15th? What do you think that we could do as fans to help curb this. Man, I wanted to say pandemic, but it's not. That's not the word. What would you? You understand what I'm trying to say? I keep throwing that out there. What do you think we should do as people who love the people that we watch to not hurt anybody else, if that makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I think we have to recognize, first of all, that these are people. And we tend to see them as larger than life. We tend to, you know, excuse behavior with saying, you know, they're well paid, they've reached this point in their life, they've got to have thick skin, they can take it. I think the accessibility that we have to these people through Twitter, through now Twitch streams and whatever the case may be, I think that's just made it, the barriers have come down from fans and, you know, reporters or whatever the case may be and the talent to the point where, you know, we still see them in some ways as larger than life, but our access to them has changed drastically. And, you know, I think if you see what Kayla Braxton, for example, has gone through, you know, the kind of messages she gets when she changes her hair color and posts a picture of it. And, you know, she has to delete her Twitter because it's too much for her to handle. And so, you know, that access has really given people carte blanche for whatever reason to say things that they wouldn't say to people's faces or things like that. So, you know, I go back to the old adage.
But Greg, what can we do, like, as people who notice this? What can we do as people who appreciate that and notice, can we do proactively?
I think, you know, well, and that's the thing. Proactive is it's tough. I try to lead by example. You know, I hope that anyone who follows me on Twitter or, you know, that's really the only social media that I use wrestling with knows me by now and knows how I view wrestling and the wrestlers and the respect that I have for them, even if I don't like the shows or their matches or something like that. Like Bruce said, you're not criticizing the person in a personal way. You're criticizing what's happening on television with their character, what's being fed to them by WWE or whomever it may be. So I think just, you know, trying to also be more positive is something. And I'm not saying, you know, you need to have an equal balance or if something's crappy, just find something positive to it. But I think when there are things that are positive, call those out. You know, in terms of being proactive, I don't know that there's a lot with someone with limited reach can do, you know. I'm not someone who has 20 million followers and can post something on Twitter and affect great change. All I can do is within the confines of my feed, which is to try to lead by example and try to interact with fans or with wrestlers. I don't interact with wrestlers very often for this reason. You know, I don't want anything I say to be misconstrued. I don't tag wrestlers at all in my post about them because I just don't think it's necessary. They don't need that hassle, you know? So just kind of leading by example, I think is what I can do. Someone who has a somewhat decent level of following on Twitter and is not someone who can, you know, affect great change in that sphere.
Yeah. I think one thing we could try to do, Craig, and I should say published author, Craig, is that lift up the people you want to lift up, right? And I'm not someone that tags wrestlers either, but that doesn't stop me from liking and retweeting their stuff or quote-tweeting their things, right? So if there are people that have a positive impact on you and you want others to know that, hype their stuff for them, right? I'm sure they'd appreciate that. But as Greg said, there's not much that we as individuals can do that's proactive besides trying our best to create an atmosphere right now where there is more positivity than negativity. The more reactive stuff, of course, is getting the trolls and the negative people right when they do that stuff, pointing them out, you know, harping on them. Sometimes it feeds their ego because they get in their attention, but you also don't want that to just be set as want that to be out there as an example to follow. So it's a difficult situation, Craig, and you know there's never going to be a right answer, but there are plenty of wrong answers that we've seen too much, especially on social media.
Absolutely, dude. I mean, brilliantly said, PhD guy. Last thing, and then I'll get off the line here. Thanks for taking my call. And I love you guys so deeply. G1 is coming up. I haven't seen that there's a schedule for wrestlers that are going to be in the G1. Who of anybody who's out there would you like to see in the G1? And if Ishii doesn't win this year, I'm going to Japan. I'm punching every Japanese person. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Craig. Japan's in a tough spot, Bruce, because they've got the Olympics coming up. They've got very few of their population vaccinated, and I don't know if they're going to try to ramp that situation up with the Olympics coming, because there's going to be a lot of negative press coming their way with the Olympics going there and with the risk that a lot of the athletes are going to be put in. And then you have, you know, the wrestlers themselves who, you know, New Japan's had an outbreak or two recently of COVID-19 positive tests. And if that happens during the G1, I mean, we've seen Ghetto be able to book on the fly for the G1 before, but this is going to be like nothing he's ever had to deal with. So it's just going to be a very tough situation. It's going to be really touch and go. As far as who would we like to see in the G1, I'm assuming, you know, aside from the usual suspects, you know, Samoa Joe is somebody you could throw out there. I don't know what condition he's in. You know, WWE medicals apparently would not pass him. So I don't know if the G1 is exactly something I should be wishing upon him right now. Samoa Joe of 10 years ago, if somehow he could transform, would be someone who would be really interesting. There's some sick interest of seeing Braun Strowman in the G1. Partially because he's improved so much. When you go against an Okada or a Tanahashi, I think that really tests your level of how well you've improved. So, that's kind of interesting. Having New Japan open the doors to AEW could conceivably have some wrestlers there in the G1, and there are some interesting guys who are in AEW who, if New Japan is looking to fill out their G1 blocks, you might be able to get a guy or two from AEW, which would be really interesting on a lot of levels and could play into an AEW storyline. But are there any other wrestlers outside of the norm, maybe, that you would like to see in the G1 this year?
I think you brought up Braun Strowman. I don't want to see him, but of the releases, I think two people make perfect sense, and that would be Tommy End and Buddy Murphy to be in the G1. I think their styles are perfect for New Japan, and especially for someone like Murphy, where it will be based more on just the in-ring wrestling. He's a fantastic wrestler, and I think for him, that could be a great way to reestablish his name outside of WWE by having a good showing in the G1. I've been on record saying that I think that so I'm going to move into who I think should win real quick, because I think who we should see, you kind of gone over the names of who should be there or the people that the ones that people want to see there. But I think that this G1, and Craig is not going to like this, but I think this G1 should be set up for a Shingo Takagi win. And I know he's facing Okada for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship here soon, but I don't think it's the right moment for him to become champion yet. I think the correct path is to take Takagi on that journey of having him win the G1 and then winning the title at Wrestle Kingdom. So that's what I would like to see happen for the G1. But regardless of what happens in the G1, as with all of them, it should be fantastic wrestling, a fantastic tournament, and hopefully after, you know, with what happened with Evil and Tetsuya Naito last year, I hope they reassert kind of that booking you know New Japan to have. And you know, I think the journey of Takagi is one that fans want to go on.
All right, we'll finish up with an email question here. This is from Zach in Texas. He says, gentlemen, with the debut of Andrade on Dynamite Friday as Vicky Guerrero's boy toy du jour, the rich keep getting richer. The first round of releases is about to be available. Daniel Bryan is on the market, and now there's a second round of releases. Daniel Bryan, we forgot about him for the G1. Mm-hmm. Daniel Bryan is on the market, and now there's a second round of releases that will be on the market just in time for All Out. Cough, Heidi Lovelace, cough. There was a time when they were hoarding talent just to keep them away from the competition. Now they can't get rid of prime, mostly misused or underutilized talent fast enough. What do you think precipitated this change, and why would they want to further enrich AEW, especially with AEW booking being so much better than theirs? Well, I think it's a couple of things. It could be John Laurinaitis coming into talent relations and being in charge. I think that's part of it. I think Nick Khan being so powerful in WWE's front office, and just a philosophical change of, okay, at one time we wanted to hoard all this talent so AEW couldn't get it, but now we're so rich that even if AEW gets this talent, they're still never going to be on our level. So why are we carrying this extra debt? We can make even more money with even fewer wrestlers. So I think that's part of it too, although ultimately the decision would come down to Vince McMahon in every case. Do you see anything different as to why all of a sudden WWE for years would cut as few people as possible as now doing more bloodletting recently than they've done?
People are talking about, you know, having a sale, and this is what you do when you try to have a sale, you cut costs or whatnot. I don't think that's the case. For me, I think a lot of these contracts were signed shortly after AEW debuted. And I think in WWE's mind, they're like, you know what, we're going to keep the talent away from them and hope that they fail, and once they fail, we'll be fine. But they haven't failed. But they also haven't blown WWE out of the water either. And I think from that perspective, WWE looks at it and says, you know what, Braun Strowman costs a lot of money. We're not really doing – he was just in the WWE Championship picture, but he's kind of your big man gimmick you see all the time in WWE, and that's replaceable as we see with Omos right now. And the other characters, the other wrestlers who were released, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but most of them weren't doing anything on TV either. And so I just want to say that it has more to do with the fact that they don't think AEW is as much competition as fans want them to be in the eyes of WWE, I should say. Right, not that I'm saying that AEW is. It's that I think from WWE's perspective, the luster may have worn off a little bit from AEW, and they're not as fearful of them signing up their guys. Because, I mean, they signed Christian Cage, and it hasn't gone well. They signed Paul White. It's been kind of a mixed bag. Now they signed Mark Henry. Who knows? So I think they look at the track record besides Moxley, right, and kind of look at it as, they're not really doing anything anyway, or they're not getting too well with them anyway. So it's not going to be a big loss to us.
Speaking of AEW, next week they have Miro versus Evil Uno for the TNT Championship, Penta, Pac, and Eddie Kingston against Brandon Cutler and the Young Bucks in six-man tag action. And then there's Adam Page and 10 of the Dark Order against Brian Cage and Hobbs. Before we go, last thing, Andrade's debut on AEW, what'd you think?
I think it would have been much better without Vicky Guerrero. If he had just interrupted without Guerrero, I think it would have been fine. But looking at Andrade specifically, he looks like a million bucks. He had that charisma, the confidence about him, that it factor. You could feel it coming through the screen. He was confident on the mic. We were told he couldn't speak English, but I was trying to tell people covering Raw, like, when he's given the chance, he can speak English pretty well. I was able to understand him. And so I think, I mean, talk about the rich getting richer. AEW, he is more likely to challenge for the world title sooner than later, based just on his presentation from Friday night. And I think if you're AEW, that's good. If you're Andrade El Idolo, that's good. If you're WWE, you're not going to see it as bad or as you missed the ball, but you definitely missed the mark with Andrade.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's going to be a big loss for WWE.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's it. Thank you for staying with us for a little longer than usual, Bruce, here on Wrestling Night in America. Appreciate it. Thanks for your insight on wrestling and, you know, beyond wrestling here. Before you go ahead and plug what you do for The Torch and your social media where people can follow you.
Sure, and thank you for the invite, Greg. I really enjoyed talking to you and the callers and the emailers, and I hope my insights were, if not informative, at least enjoyable to the listeners and the emailers. So on Twitter, you can find me at B_Lee253. I do the alt perspective reports for The Torch, and I also do some news stories here and there for The Torch as well. You can also find my work at dailyddt.com. And so, yeah, B_Lee253, pwtorch.com, and dailyddt.com, and, of course, go VIP.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate you being on the show this week.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can tune in next Sunday night. Wrestling Night in America will be here. I will not. It will be the PWT Talks NXT crew guiding you through the post-NXT TakeOver In Your House post-show. So come along for that. Call in. Give your perspective and opinions. Email in to the show and hear the feedback. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. I'm Greg Parks, PW Torch columnist. You can follow me at Greg M. Parks. Talk to you again soon, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.